Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, I am talking with Amy Hughes. She writes a monthly column addressing national, state, and regional issues for New Times, an alternative newspaper in San Luis Obispo, California. In 2017, Hughes retired from a career as Director of Marketing and Communications for Cal Poly College of Engineering, where she was responsible for strategic planning of the college public relations and advancement communications program. In former lives, Hughes served as Assistant Director of Admissions for Wells College, Executive Administrator for the Planning and Conservation League, and Director of Californians Against Waste. She helped lead a grassroots legislative lobbying campaign and statewide initiative for a deposit on throwaway beverage containers. A graduate of Smith College, Amy earned her master's degree in English from Cal Poly. She is married to poet Kevin Clark, who brings her words every day, Hughes says. She is an avid reader, gardener, ocean swimmer, and hiker. She's grateful for her three book groups, especially her mother-daughter group, now in its 17th year. Welcome to the program, Amy.
Thank you so much, Sheila. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to talk about your work and your transforming from one kind of writer in marketing and communication to another kind of writer in your opinion pieces in the newspaper. So let's start with the transition. How is it in your career, having written for marketing and public relations and now writing your opinion?
For Cal Poly, over 20 years, I wrote and published a 32-page biannual newsletter and a 60-page annual report. And I got to write about wonderful engineering students and faculty who are doing all these cool projects like designing and launching little satellites. Anyway, they were really fun stories about students and faculty, and that gave me a beginning basis to develop my kind of narrative style, which relies very much on the voices of people in the community, or in this case, our students and faculty themselves. But I retired in 2017, the year of the Trump inauguration. I was wondering how to engage politically and obviously feeling a lot of distress. And in the past, I worked for environmental causes, was a legislative aide to a California state legislator, Tom Bates of Berkeley. So I had a lot of experience writing speeches and legislation and press releases and advocacy documents. So that was all of a wonderful background and a way to build up a portfolio and a voice. And when I retired that summer, 2017, I was with my husband, the poet Kevin Clark, at the Rainier Writers Workshop, and I got to attend all these wonderful, fantastic readings, but everyone there was grappling with what to do, how to write in life after the 2016 election, and they put together a panel of these key national writers who talked about that, the importance of contributing op-ed pieces, letters to the editor, basically lending our writing expertise to what was happening all around us. And then somebody sent me a notice that the New Times was looking for a progressive columnist, and I thought, okay, well, what the heck? I threw together a resume and cover letter and writing examples, and I never heard back. But a couple months later, the editor contacted me and said, you know, the columnists we hired flaked out, and could I come up with 850 words in 3 days?
Oh, my.
So I did, and they liked it, and that gave me the foothold for a monthly column.
That's exciting, and things work that way sometimes. So first choices in hiring aren't always the best choices. So I'm glad that you
right.
got the job. That brings me to a lot of what you've said about how to engage during these times post that inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
The paper, you called it an alternative paper, which of course we've used for a long time to discuss non-mainstream papers. But in this climate, mm-hmm. especially since Kellyanne Conway coined the term alternative facts, do we
right.
need a new name? What do we mean by alternative press?
Well, let's not cede the rhetorical distinction to Kellyanne Conway. The paper is alternative because it is an alternative to daily national syndications like Hearst or McClatchy. It's locally owned. It's a giveaway weekly that covers arts and entertainment, opinion, and local issues. And it goes into much more depth on issues affecting our county and less ink to those state or national news and AP stories. So it offers a venue for opposing and I would say alternative interpretation and voices. Uh-huh. So I think we want to make sure that we're not grinding a narrative and that Kellyanne is always grinding a narrative. And we want to stand up with good facts and good words to oppose that.
So what you're writing for the New Times local publication is under a category called rhetoric and reason, or is it the other way, reason and rhetoric?
Rhetoric and reason.
Okay. And I know from a past discussion with you that you didn't create that name for the category that your columns go under. How does it make you think when you're writing your columns that they're going under that label?
Well, as I said when I applied for the position, I would hope to contribute more reason and less rhetoric. That we find ourselves these days kind of caught in a Mobius strip or a loop of opposing opinions. We need to cut through that cacophony and strike people, use our words to move people's emotions and make them think, not just react. That's getting out of that Mobius loop. That's what I hope rhetoric and reason means in the columns that I contribute. Uh-huh.
And so you come up with a fresh one every month?
I do.
And how do you approach finding your topics and writing your pieces?
There's so many issues, Sheila. I mean, every day is an issue that I could write about in the newspaper. And I'm free to choose any topic I wish, which is very liberating. I usually bounce off a current or an ongoing outrage and give it a local and or personal focus. So I've written about the Women's March, white privilege, attacks on Planned Parenthood, Trump's opening the entire national coastline to drilling, a congressional bill to allow dangerous storage and transportation of nuclear waste, and of course we have a nuclear plant here in our county. But I also consider the local issues that are resonating in communities across the nation, hunger, health care, homelessness, gun violence. And so I try to contextualize and personalize these unsightly and ungainly challenges, not just to add my voice to the issues, but to give voice to those in our community that are affected by these problems directly. So I've talked to the homeless individuals living in our creekside encampments. I've gone to the food bank and interviewed the director and visited a food distribution center. I went to the new Center for Homeless Services. So I try to really put some boots on the ground in terms of local issues. And that gives me lots of options every month. I mean, sometimes the problem is, okay, narrow this down instead of go wide. You kind of have to, in 850 words, it's not a lot to go deep, but you can go deeper if you sort of narrow that focus.
So this whole way you're speaking about researching and focusing reminds me of what you said about the writing that you did for the annual report. You said you like to talk about the people themselves and give them voice, and sounds like you've brought that over very nicely to what you're doing. Is this a weekly paper and your column appears once a month?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So how does the audience that you're writing for in your town or county engage with you?
My husband and I both post the articles to our own Facebook, so that gives it a little bit of a bounce. Of course, those are usually supporters, uh-huh. people who agree with us, so and me. So that's very positive. The paper itself, obviously, like most papers today, has an online presence, and that you can post comments there as well. And I do get comments. There are sometimes the usual suspects, people who write opinion pieces or letters to the editor, and you see their names over and over again. And sometimes I can recognize those names because I've seen them in the local paper, the local daily paper. People do engage that way. Because I often interview city officials and elected officials, I'm hoping they track their mention, their when I use their words and quote them, they're tracking that as well. So the hope would be that other people pick up on the theses or ideas or points of view that I'm advocating and hopefully carry those through in other venues, to legislation or whatever, things that would make a difference.
I like the idea that the people you're interviewing are interested in seeing what you've said in your opinion piece, and it's another way of spreading some thinking around. They get maybe behind more things than they might have been because of your interviews. It's exciting to think that way.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with San Luis Obispo writer Amy Hughes about writing opinion columns for her local alternative newspaper.
I think you've prepared to read from one of your columns for us.
I am. I appreciate the opportunity. This is a piece that I did in 2017 called Persist and Resist with the Women's March. Resistance is futile, intoned the Borg, an evil race encountered by the Starship Enterprise. Well, it's been a Borg year, starting with corrosive dread, as poet Kevin Clark puts it, following the election, and continuing day after day after day with attacks on civil rights, voting rights, immigrants, women's health, reproductive rights, health care, and the environment. It's exhausting to even keep up on all the ways in which this Borg administration daily devalues our moral and ethical standards and rolls back regulatory protections that safeguard the health and welfare of individuals, our society, and the environment. After a year, you have to ask, is resistance futile? Wind back to January 21st, 2017, when our collective corrosive dread led to the Women's March, drawing 5 million participants in the U.S. and around the world, including 10,000 here in San Luis Obispo. By all accounts, this was the largest single-day protest in U.S. history. While my husband marched on Higuera Street, my daughter and I marched on Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C. My election-induced miasma started to lift when we boarded the plane in Phoenix and found that 98% of the passengers were women marchers. Our seatmate, a smartly dressed Republican in her early 70s, said, "I had to come." She recounted an experience that served as a lifelong moral touchstone. At 8, she went to a Girl Scout camp in Texas that was integrated for the first time. On an overnight horse ride, white men in pickups with rifles appeared. The girls spent the night huddled in a local park with police protection. She said, "I had vowed I'd never feel that kind of shame again." These were the stories and the voices we heard in D.C., San Luis Obispo, and across the globe. What was the point, you ask? What did this action, these voices, wrought? Essayist Rebecca Solnit stated, "Actions often ripple far beyond their immediate objective, and remembering this is reason to live by principle and act in hope that what you do matters. And even when results are unlikely, the effects can be far-ranging." I submit that one of the more immediate ripples of the Women's March was helping to catalyze the landslide Me Too movement. We can thank Harvey Weinstein, of course, but when women are empowered to use their voices, well, the mighty can fall. Here's a long-standing local example. Mothers for Peace in San Luis Obispo came together in 1969 to take action against the Vietnam War. For the last 42 years, they have served as a principal watchdog of Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. Using legal channels, including 25 legal challenges since the meltdown of Fukushima, Mothers for Peace have stood their ground, raised their voices, and helped safeguard our community. As they state, perseverance is our strong suit. Back to the Women's March. For local organizer Terry Perry, the action was born out of disbelief, grief, and hopelessness. But since the Trump inauguration, the San Luis Obispo event catapulted into an ongoing movement to bring rapid response to damaging policies. The first of these was the Muslim travel ban, said Perry. They organized a demonstration that drew hundreds within a day's notice. That crystallized our mission. We would provide a way for the community to assemble, show resistance, take action, and feel support. More than 2 years later, Women's March SLO is still serving to re-energize, motivate, and celebrate resistant successes. It's a powerful catalyst for renewal. Let's all join Women's March SLO and commit to persist and resist.
Thank you, Amy. I've recently heard the term moral injury, that psychologists are beginning to say that this bombardment of things that are against our principles is actually resulting in moral injury. It is overwhelmingly wonderful to hear the hope that comes through in that column. And part of that hope comes from the numbers and the breadth countrywide of people resisting and persisting. So I want to thank
Absolutely.
You for that.
Yeah. I wrote that column in particular out of a feeling of discouragement. And I mean, we all have low days. And I absolutely agree that we are all suffering from moral indignation and sadness. There's sadness around us. So we have to speak out and find ways, find what it is that keeps us moving forward.
So you probably have things to tell listeners who have thought about writing a letter to the editor or hope to write opinion pieces about how you might share how you approach it. I think we have a flavor of it from your history and from the sample you just read. But what should people think about if they're going to write a letter of, say, outrage or disagreement or persuasion as a letter to the editor, which is probably the fastest route to publication for lay audience?
It is. Letters to the editor differentiate from what I do in that they're much shorter. It's 200 words. They're really targeted as responses to an opinion in that paper, maybe an editorial piece, or news stories, or even other letters to the editor. That's a sort of a quick response to something that has already been stated. An opinion piece, I get to play with about 800 to 900 words, so there's more space in that article to make a strong thesis statement or pursue and advocate for a particular point of view. What makes a good piece? Any kind of writing, the basis is good writing that is succinct and crafted to elicit some kind of emotional response. For the paper and audience I write for, I use images and voices that readers may know personally. That's one way to connect with people, is like, oh, that's our city council mayor or someone that they've read about in the news. And frankly, it's not hard. You have to give yourself a little time because they're busy people, but it's not hard to get responses if you craft even two or three questions to ask public officials or elected officials. They will get back to you on issues. So that's one way to draw in an audience and make a difference with a column and get it noticed. I often actually in my columns call out to people to remember things that affected them personally, like in writing about opening the coast to drilling. The Santa Barbara oil spill started Earth Day years and years ago, decades ago, and we've had more than one oil spill here. And I said, remember those? Well, imagine that's happening in Morro Bay. And then drew a picture of what it would look like to have an oil spill of that size, like Deepwater Horizon or any of the other oil spills happen here locally. So paint a picture that affects people personally and directly. For a local columnist or letter to the editor, I think that that's a way to get the most audience response and recognition.
So the persuasiveness comes from a description of the outcome, should something not or be passed.
Yes, exactly. for instance, I drew after Parkland. I did research. Hey, it's always important to have good facts. I mean, you must research. Let's not have any more alternative facts. Let's use actual facts. So I would say make sure that whatever your thesis is, back it up with a reasoned argument that includes data. So for the gun violence thing, I thought a lot about my daughter's a social worker. She's worked in domestic violence for years, and I began to see that there's a parallel between gun violence and domestic violence. And so interviewed people locally that deal with those issues and talk to them about that connection. And then what can we do? What are the practical strategies we can adopt as a city or a county to counteract this scourge of violence that affects women disproportionately?
So I'm hearing three things. Make it personal with voices that people can recognize from their community.
Correct.
Use facts, mm-hmm. actual facts, and have some sort of call for action.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's my approach. I feel particularly today that it's not enough to just leave your readers or an audience enraged. Mm-hmm. that just leads to kind of more hopelessness and frustration. I want to, as much as I can, to suggest a plan of action, a way for them to connect and make a difference themselves.
Very well said. Out of our moral injury, it does create rage. And that is often what we show in discussions or in our writing. And rage isn't really persuasive, is it?
No. Years ago, I went door to door to raise money for the bottle bill campaign here in California, which is the recycling 5-cent deposit bill. I found early on that simply engaging with people who had their own point of view and thought I was a communist or something was not going to get me anywhere. It just doesn't get you anywhere. There is a conservative columnist that writes in New Times that I write opposite. He has engaged me personally. I mean, after I wrote about nuclear power and nuclear waste, the title of his next column was, "I like nuclear power. I like coal." I thought, okay. But I just do not want to get into a tit-for-tat argument with people who oppose my opinion, because right. what I want to do is turn hearts and mm-hmm. minds and then provide a way for other people to become engaged.
Right. So I want to be sure to mention where people can find your columns in the archives of New Times. And what I have here is www.newtimeslow.com, S-L-O. So what does that stand for?
The name of the paper is New Times San Luis Obispo, and we always
okay.
San Luis Obispo.
I have trouble with screen names. They seem to be their own entity as opposed to standing for what they stand for. Thank you. So are all the columns you've written archived there under Rhetoric
yes,
and Reason?
Yes, they are. Yeah, if you go to Rhetoric and Reason under Opinion, you go mm-hmm. to Opinion and then Rhetoric and Reason. There's a nice search function. You can search for my name, and all of the columns I've published will come up. But you can also just look at my opposition's columns as well as
right.
mine. They have a whole archive of columns.
Have you ever done the same thing, written a column right in opposition? It doesn't sound like you would have, but have you done that?
I would say no. I try to write in opposition to ideas, and I started my interest in politics was always issue-related rather than candidate or party politic-related. That's where my heart is in issue politics. And so I don't want to simply talk about a candidate necessarily. I mean, I would endorse a candidate, but I would talk about a candidate's stand on an issue mm-hmm. that I think either needs to be highlighted in opposition or support. Again, I would go to the issues. I would also recommend to your listeners who are interested in this that obviously they need to educate themselves and do wide reading of other columnists and editorials and letters to the editor. Rebecca Solnit, who I read, I think is one of our smartest essayists in the world now. But, you know, I like Gail Collins. I like her voice. I like the way she engages you. So you have to find your own voice, your own tone that you're comfortable with.
What about editing? Are you edited by the newspaper?
Actually, I'm not, or very little. I'm edited by my husband.
A trusted reader.
Yeah, I let Kevin, he helps me in just reading every column I write. But I think because of my years of writing and publishing for all the different colleges and causes, I'm pretty clean in terms of grammar and that kind of stuff.
The editors of the newspaper are probably very pleased that there's not much work to do on your columns.
It saves them time, I'm
right.
sure. I have no idea, of course, how much
right.
they have to edit other columnists.
Right.
But
right.
what I see printed is what I've given them, by and large. I mean, sometimes they cut words if I've gone over the word
right.
limit.
I want to thank you so much for sharing your expertise and history of writing. And I know I, for one, will be checking the archives of the New Times SLO to see what your opinions are, because even though they're centered on your community, there's so many likenesses around, especially West Coast communities right now, but all around the country. So I want to thank you so much for the interview and your time telling us about your new life as an opinion writer.
Oh, Sheila, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.